Hola, I'm Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States.
There's a crisis of power in Venezuela, and the United States had this message for the country.
Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He's never won the presidency in a free and fair election, and he's maintained his grip of power by imprisoning anyone who dares to oppose him. The United States joins with all freedom-loving nations in recognizing the National Assembly as the last vestige of democracy in your country, for it's the only body elected by you, the people.
The Trump administration has long opposed and battled President Nicolas Maduro, including considering a military intervention in Venezuela in 2017. And now the U.S. has a new figure to put their support behind, opposition leader Juan Guaido.
Asumir formalmente las competencias del Ejecutivo Nacional.
On Wednesday, the streets of Caracas and cities across Venezuela were filled with protesters backing Guaido. After Guaido swore himself in, Venezuelan supporters sang the national anthem. And in a statement, President Trump formally recognized Guaido as president, echoing the words of Vice President Pence.
We say to all the good people of Venezuela, estamos con ustedes. We are with you. We stand with you. And we will stay with you until democracy is restored and you reclaim your birthright of libertad.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In just a moment, we'll talk more about the U.S. support of a transition of power, or what some would call a coup. But we begin in Caracas, where at least seven protesters have been reported killed in this week's protests. Ana Vanessa Herrero is a reporter for The New York Times on the ground, and she's been covering the protests.
So we are talking about several protests only on Monday, at least 13 in different slums. This is the important part and the different part from other years, because in 2017, 2014, we saw the east of Caracas, which was middle class, upper middle class, on the streets wanting to take their rights back. But right now, things were completely different. This happened on Monday, and on Tuesday happened the same thing overnight. But yesterday, this Wednesday, it was overwhelming. We saw hundreds of thousands of people in Venezuela, in the country, marching and asking Maduro to step back and to open a path for transition. That was the opposition, because the government also called for a demonstration this Wednesday. And although they did have people on the streets, mostly ministry workers, it was completely different from before also, because I couldn't see more than maybe 100 people in one rally. So that was the scenario yesterday. And then after Juan Guaido took the next step and declared himself as president, as interim president, people again started going out to the streets, and clashes began. They began around 2 p.m. Caracas time, and they ended around 3 a.m. Caracas time.
Let's talk a little bit about Guaido, who is the person who, the opposition leader, who essentially has just named himself interim president in Venezuela. Are we on the verge of a coup? Is this a coup? And what can you tell us about his supporters?
Okay, so the first thing we need to know is that Venezuela has two realities right now. For the opposition, for the National Assembly, this is completely constitutional. The Constitution says that if the president is no longer available, if he is declared insane, or if he can't fulfill the work, then the president of the National Assembly should take and has to take power and has to assume the presidency. That is what they're doing. They say that Nicolas Maduro is not the president anymore. He's usurping power. So if that spot, they need to fill that spot with something. So the next logical step inside of the Constitution is Juan Guaido.
More than 2 million Venezuelans have left the country in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. There are now two people claiming to be the president. Venezuela has been dealing with a humanitarian crisis for quite some time. Where does the country go from here, Ana?
Yesterday, when I was at the demonstration, something caught my attention was that many people that I talked to while they were marching said, well, I have nothing else to lose. My family, you know, half of my family is in 7 or 8 different countries. They're not even in the same country anymore. So they're not even together in exile. I have nothing to eat. I have an income salary that is about $6 a month. That is the minimum wage here in Venezuela. So you know what? I don't really care anymore. And that was the sentiment yesterday. With that kind of a feeling, it doesn't seem likely to go for something better. I think Venezuela is touching deep ground right now. And this has to follow its natural path. So really, I mean, that question, actually, it's really hard to answer.
Ana Vanessa Herrero is a reporter for the New York Times. Thanks, Ana.
Thank you so much.
From the streets of Caracas, we now go to Washington, where American support for the opposition pushed President Maduro to break off relations with the United States on Wednesday. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina. It's good to be with you.
So let's start off by talking about the Vice President Pence's video message. What was your reaction to that initially?
Well, I think it was a very bold and strong statement of support for the opposition leader. It's not the normal thing necessarily for a U.S. vice president to be so direct in voicing support for an opposition leader in a foreign country. But having said that, it is part of a process that's been building for some time. The vice president has been very vocal about the need for change in Venezuela. Every time he travels to Latin America, it's a priority issue. Other senior administration officials have clearly made this a topic of conversation. So in that context, it's not anything that perhaps we wouldn't anticipate.
This particular administration, the Trump administration, has been very hostile to anyone coming across. You know, we have the issue on our southern border. A lot of those folks have been fleeing violence and other issues in Latin America. And a lot of the protesters we're seeing on the ground in Venezuela are actually lower income, poorer Venezuelans, not wealthier Venezuelans. So I'm trying to see how the administration can feel some sort of compassion or desire to help this population of Venezuela while also extending policies that seem to hurt the wider population.
You know, this is a very relevant question.
It does feel like a contradiction here, and it's hard for me to grasp.
Well, it can, absolutely. And I think the answer to that would be, and I don't speak for the administration, but from an outsider perspective, it would seem that the answer to that could be that they look at some of the population flows from Central America as a domestic issue, in other words, an immigration issue into the United States, whereas they're viewing Venezuela as a foreign policy issue. And so if you take it from that different reference points, then I think you begin to see how a difference in approach could come to be.
President Trump said on Wednesday that, quote, all options are on the table when it comes to military action in Venezuela. As we know, this administration is not a fan of President Nicolas Maduro. Is that something you would support, any type of military intervention? Is that realistic given what's happening on the ground?
I don't think that's imminent, and I don't think it's something that should occur except in the most dire of circumstances. Saying that all options are on the table is generally a statement of fact, because that is just a reality. There are other options there. But in saying that, it does seem to be laying a marker for the Maduro regime, which is to say, don't take action against Juan Guaido, who we, the United States, have recognized, and many other countries around the world have recognized as the interim president of Venezuela, and don't do anything that would necessitate some sort of stronger response from the United States. But having said that, no, I don't think that particular issue is imminent, and Latin Americans would not support a military intervention. I think that would change the circumstances dramatically. It would bilateralize the situation, turn it into a U.S. versus Venezuela issue, whereas, in fact, the issue should remain focused on the ground in Caracas.
What about sanctions against Venezuela, particularly, you mentioned crude oil. What about sanctions there? I mean, how realistic is it that the U.S. could enact more sanctions?
Well, I think it's very realistic, particularly to the extent extent that Maduro does not leave office anytime soon. I think the U.S. Will continue to ratchet up pressure, and the logical next step, because it will have the largest impact, is the energy sector. That is basically the sole earner of hard currency for Venezuela. And so the United States has real leverage there, but has resisted doing anything significant on the energy sector for years on the assumption that, in fact, doing so would hurt the Venezuelan people. And nobody wants to do that. They're looking to influence behavior by the government, but not hurt the people.
The United States also, as we know, has a long history of interfering in Latin American politics. You know, and much of that is also influenced, as I mentioned earlier, the migrations that we're seeing into the United States. What does the United States have to do under this administration or future administrations to move forward on the issue of Venezuela without repeating what it's done in the past, without having this strong arm, you know, U.S. is going to come in and take over?
Nothing happens in a vacuum, and I can tell you with direct knowledge that people are aware of the perceptions of the history of the United States in Latin America.
Well, not just the perceptions, the realities also.
Well, sure, and you can have that discussion, and certainly during different time periods, the U.S. has been very directly involved. And so it is very clear that the administration, to a greater or lesser extent, following the pathway laid down by the Obama administration beforehand, has been doing what it can to allow a consensus within the Western Hemisphere and Latin America specifically to develop, to take the lead in addressing this issue so that the United States is not put in a position to have to intervene directly or in some military manner.
Also, I'm wondering if you see any parallels here with this sort of behind-the-scenes approach between what we're seeing now and the U.S. intervention in Chile in 1973 that ultimately led to the coup.
I don't. It's a different time. It's a different place. It's certainly a different country. And I just think the two aren't that related.
In terms of support, Canada also recognized Guaido, like the United States did this week. A number of other countries have in Latin America. Mexico, however, and Uruguay are not supporting Guaido. Well, how will that impact our relationship with Mexico going forward?
Well, it's a disappointment in my view, but not a surprise that Mexico has chosen this path, and the same with Uruguay. Does that bleed over into the bilateral relationship, particularly as the U.S. Congress is set to consider perhaps the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the replacement for NAFTA in the relatively near timeframe? It could complicate things, but at the end of the day, I think Congress is going to be more interested in voting on things like, you know, provisions in the auto sector that might create jobs in their districts or in their states, as opposed to what the president of Mexico might have to say or not have to say in Venezuela.
Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're 34 days into the government shutdown. With healthcare workers furloughed and federal funding for clinics suspended, the shutdown is taking a heavy toll on the 2.2 million American Indians who depend on the Indian Health Service. This is despite the fact that the federal government is required to provide medical care to Native people through treaty agreements. In Seattle, an urban Indian health center has been forced to make some difficult decisions.
So this last Saturday was our last Saturday clinic.
Aaron Spark is a government affairs officer at the Seattle Indian Health Board, and he's also an American Indian from the Chupik tribe in western Alaska.
We offer what we consider a very innovative healthcare model called Indigenous Knowledge-Informed Care, which is very holistic. We meet the patient where they're at with traditional Indian medicine at its core, and we're not able to offer that on Saturdays for our community anymore.
The vast majority of American Indians live in urban areas and go to clinics like the one in Seattle where Aaron works. With the partial government shutdown, urban Indian health centers are going without grant money from the federal government.
This does affect our contracts with the Indian Health Service. And when we did the analysis, it's about 25% of our funds. And we looked at it on the weekly, and it's about $75,000 a week. So it's a pretty big impact that we're facing.
Aaron says the health center is also considering scaling back other programs due to the shutdown. But funding from the federal government has always been tight.
We're not funded very well from the federal level. Even though we have this federal trust responsibility from the federal government to pay for our health care, they pay us at such a woefully low level that we have to look at any and all third-party revenue to really keep our doors open.
More on this issue, we reached out to Mark Trahant.
Let me just kind of take a little back in history.
Mark is the editor of the Indian News website, Indian Country Today, and a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock tribe. And he says that while the Indian Health Service budget might be subject to a political fight, it's still a lot better than it used to be.
When treaties were signed with tribes, one of the main provisions of the treaties was to say, in exchange for all this land you're giving up, we're going to send a doctor and a nurse to your reservation. And that, over the years, has become codified as a promise to conduct healthcare. And up through the 1950s, the healthcare was extraordinarily bad and underfunded. One doctor threw up his hands in disgust in 1955 and said, this is just unconscionable. Finally, Congress transferred it to the Public Health Service. And since then, it's been kind of a steady improvement. In fact, one thing that most people don't know is if you look at Indian health statistics in the 1970s versus today. In the 1970s, American Indians and Alaska Natives had an average age of death around 44, and now it's not that far behind the general population. So there are some pretty striking success stories.
But things are far from perfect today.
The Indian Health Service in general is extraordinarily low-funded. I think the last number I saw was about 60% of need. So compared to any other public health system, it's underfunded to begin with. And urban Indian health clinics are even lower funded than that. They're just 1% of the whole Indian Health Service budget.
Trahant says this chronic underfunding means it's difficult to get medical personnel to work at these clinics.
The Indian Health Service has always got issues trying to recruit physicians and other healthcare professionals, and this will just make it worse.
American Indians and Alaska Natives die at higher rates than other Americans from issues like liver disease, diabetes, and other chronic lower respiratory illnesses. Add to that higher rates of poverty, and Trahant says the impact of the shutdown has been swift for American Indians.
People need medicine, and they can't get medicine, particularly for chronic diseases. That's where it becomes an issue of life and death, and just a great fear on how you're going to get through this week until it's over.
They're just incredibly vulnerable, and they may very well go without that care, and the consequences that occur will be what they will be.
Stacy Bolin is an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians and the CEO of the National Indian Health Board, a nonprofit organization that represents tribes in Washington, D.C.
Many of these folks do not have a plan B. They do not have access to alternative health care resources, and they certainly typically do not have the funding to pay fee-for-service for their health care. It's been pretty devastating, the impact on American Indian Alaska Native health. We've seen the cutting of programs, doctors quitting because they're not being paid and they have to put food on their tables. They have to be employed. We have tribes that have their administrative staff members have agreed to take no pay so they can aggregate that salary to keep their doctors employed. We have places where clinic hours have been cut to just a few hours a day. Flu shots are no longer being offered. Preventative services are no longer being offered because it's simply not affordable. We're basically seeing the outer edge of a major crisis looming in American Indian healthcare.
What are the options right now for people who need these services? Are they able to go to emergency rooms? Are there other alternatives in the meantime?
Well, many of the tribes are located in rural and very remote areas of the United States. And the treaties create a trust responsibility between the federal government and the Indian people. There is no plan B for most of our people who receive their services through the funding that comes through the Indian Health Service. It's important to note that while the Department of Health and Human Services, that appropriations bill did pass, the Indian Health Service is funded through the Department of Interior appropriations, and that did not pass. So not only is healthcare being completely destabilized, but all of the other services that are treaty obligations of the federal government to the tribes are also being jeopardized. So to answer your question, say you reside on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in Montana, and you could possibly present yourself at an emergency room for care. How are you going to get there? The roads are not plowed. They're buried in snow. You may not even have a car. You're talking about the most vulnerable populations of people in the United States. Some communities have upwards of 70% unemployment. These are not people who have secondary means to subsidize the federal government's responsibility for their health.
We've heard this phrase before where Americans are, quote, being held hostage by this shutdown. What are the next steps?
We continue to educate members of Congress and administration officials about the trust relationship. In the case of American Indians, this is an abrogation of treaty responsibilities. The treaties that were made with the many American Indian and Alaska Native tribes and peoples actually, in many instances, predate the establishment of the United States. And the treaty relationship with the federal government and the 573 federally recognized tribes are the basis for the government's provision of health care to American Indian and Alaska Native people. And that is a situation that is unlike any that other Americans are also experiencing. Some of our tribes have the ability to bring third-party revenues in from Medicare and Medicaid. And there is some mitigation that's able to happen because the tribes themselves are working very hard to bring resources in to keep their systems operational. Other tribes have taken out loans so that they can keep their health system operating. And there is no guarantee that when the funding actually does come through, they will be reimbursed for that stepping into the federal government's responsibility, the interest on the loans themselves. And another complicating factor that's occurring is in the Indian health system, there's a thing called purchased referred care. That means if you have to go out and see an oncologist, an orthopedic surgeon, there's a certain fund that pays for those services. There is no money. So those services are not being paid, which jeopardizes the relationships with the specialty providers who expect to be paid. In the case of Phoenix Indian Medical Center, they lease much of their equipment, like their CT scanner, their HVAC system. Those vendors are threatening to come to that facility and reclaim their equipment. They, right now, are worried about how to buy toilet paper so that they can keep that inside of their health system. And they've had massive furloughs as well.
Stacey Bolin is the CEO of the National Indian Health Board. Stacey, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I voted for Donald Trump.
I voted for Hillary Clinton.
I don't think I'm going to be interested at all anymore in any politics.
My ultimate goal is for me to get a green card.
On a day like today, politics do not matter whatsoever.
We knew it was going to be really bad, but even then I was sort of horrified at how bad it got, how quickly.
This week marks the two-year anniversary of the inauguration of Donald Trump as president. And if you could measure these last 2 years in terms of our nation's politics, well, even the well-worn narratives of America's polarized parties don't do justice to the social and cultural divide we seem to be living through today.
Like a lot of journalists, we felt like there was a story we'd missed in the lead-up to that election.
That's John Facile, lead producer of a new one-hour special, 2 Years, Diaries of a Divided Nation, presented by KCRW's political talk show, Left, Right, and Center. John and his team hoped that by focusing their coverage on ordinary Americans, they'd reveal an added dimension to the country's political topography.
We knew that what was about to happen would be very consequential and historic. And so at the beginning of 2017, our project founder, Jesse Dukes from WBEZ, came up with this idea of seeing how the Trump presidency would play out in the lives of ordinary people. For this hour-long piece that's coming out on KCRW, we zeroed in on 6 of those people who we felt like represented different parts of the country and were also dealing with partisanship and the political divide on a very personal level.
And through that personalization, these testimonials often brought to light some of the national conversations that have emerged over the past 2 years, including the Me Too movement. John told me how the renewed conversation of gender equality had had an impact on a participant named Marjorie.
Marjorie is my friend in the small town of Mexico, Maine. She's 78 years old.
In 2016, I voted for Donald Trump.
For most of 2017, she was sort of mixed on Trump.
And everything I hoped he was going to do and was going to happen don't seem to be happening.
But then in October of 2017, after the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke, I called her up and she told me about this assault.
Well, I went to lunch with my girlfriends and there was 8 of us there. And 6 out of the 8 admitted that they had been sexually assaulted back in the 50s and never said anything. Never. Well, it made me feel, I'll tell you, a ton of bricks like fell off my shoulder because the same person who had assaulted one of these girls had done it to me, and we both said nothing.
She hadn't talked about that for decades, and it really reframed the whole way she saw the world, and it changed the way she perceived Trump.
He's no better than the rest. he did it. He shouldn't get away with it.
And she wound up saying that she wouldn't vote for him again because she sort of identified him as a sexual harasser and assaulter. She wound up walking that back. And I know everybody kind of wants the story where a Trump supporter encounters something and changes their mind about Trump. That's not quite what happened. Still, it was very interesting to be on the other end of the phone and listen to her go through that.
The past 2 years have really been a whirlwind. Another turning point was the violence in Charlottesville. What impact did that have on the lives of your subjects?
So there was one person in particular who was really impacted by the violence in Charlottesville. That was Irtifa, a Muslim American woman who lives in Charlottesville. She's a PhD student. She was involved in the counter-protests during the Summer of Hate.
A few months after that, the August 12th rally happened. It was the one that got the most attention, and I saw it happen. I saw national media pick up on the level of violence.
It had a really profound impact on her that I think is impossible to overstate.
When the car attack happened, I think it was just like not even in the realm of my imagination that that could happen. I still haven't looked at any videos from that day.
And I think that event is really a traumatizing event. I mean, particularly for people of color, not just the violence, but the images.
And, you know, like I have to walk the lawn to get to my office to go teach. And that's where like I have images burned in my head of Nazis carrying torches, walking down there screaming, you know, "You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us."
But at the same time, I think everybody in America, when that happened, sort of formed this instant opinion or had a take, you know, which is what happens with so many political events.
I had only heard what Trump had said.
Adam, who's a white Trump supporter in Texas.
And he said something to the effect of, they're like bad actors on both sides, and not everybody there was a member of the KKK.
The mainstream media, once again, hysterical. Complete meltdown mode today.
When he said that, like it made sense to me.
Of course, he's rationalizing and he's trying to justify, you know, Trump's both sides comment.
I don't doubt that there are racist people out there. I guarantee you there's racist people out there. I have to believe and the good in people, or I will see the world as a very scary place that like needs to be feared.
And again, a lot of people will hear what he says and find it very, very hurtful. But it was our job to present to the best of our ability different experiences. Adam and Irtifa are talking about two completely different things almost, but we had to show that, and we were really asking ourselves, how do you show everyone's point of view in a way that's fair and real?
How did you find the answer? Yeah. I mean, it's subjective for some folks, and for others, mm-hmm. it's not. It's something that there are some norms that should not be stepped over. Yeah. How do you find that balance?
With that section, we chose clips from Irtifa and Adam where they were talking specifically about perception and perspective of Charlottesville. You can't equate their stories of that event. That's a false equivalency. You know, even Adam says in that section.
And I understand that, yeah, like I'm a middle class white guy. And so I can have the worldview that I have.
I thought that was really astute and interesting that he would be so self-aware in that way. And at the same time, Irtifa is talking about sort of the deep pain that she experienced. And I think that's a really interesting conversation. They're both kind of aware of where they're coming from.
What were some of the big changes that you noticed across the board? Were there major themes that these six individuals really exemplified for you?
I'd say the change we observed really was just how tired everybody became with politics and the current state of partisanship. There was a buzz term that went around late last year, the exhausted majority. I think exhaustion is an apt term.
John, I have a question, though.
Yeah,
When you say the exhausted majority, are we just plain old exhausted?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like very simply, yes.
Yes, right? Because I mean, can we just say like we're all burned out a little bit, not just millennials, but all Americans, I feel, are somewhat just tired. It's been a slog.
Right. And I would think that there's an opportunity right there, right? If we're all exhausted, maybe more people are open to conversations and finding solutions and compromises, and we can build bridges.
John Facile is the lead producer on 2 years, Diaries of a Divided Nation, airing on KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. John, thanks so much for the project, and thanks for your work.
Thanks, Tanzina.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.